the role of Fed. So.
Yeah, thanks. So this is on, I think. Okay, good. So I'm going to be talking about numerical simulations. And as you can tell from the title, I'm going to start with dark matter simulations, but I'm going to go into other physics, namely baryonic physics as well, in the second part of the last two-thirds of the talk. The other thing I should say is I've been on the job market, so you'll have to forgive me if there's a lot of tooting my own horn in this talk. Right. So let me start by just reminding you guys why we need simulations at all. This is what's plotted here is the linear power spectrum of cold dark matter density fluctuations. So K is the wave number. Going to the right is smaller scales. And then delta squared is K cubed P of K, so the dimensionless power spectrum. And the predictions from cold dark matter theory is that this is the solid line, which and this is linearly extrapolated to redshift zero, so today. So you can see at very large scales, the power spectrum still remains in the very linear regime. You can do analytical calculations, but then the nature of the cold dark matter power spectrum is such that it rises towards smaller scales and then eventually breaches this unity line. And so this is nonlinear structure. And so there you stand to gain a lot from doing actual numerical simulations, because it's hard to do just perturbation theory in this regime. The other thing that you can see here is I've kind of divided it into two, like a kind of dark shaded region and a gray shaded region. And on the left side here is where we actually have observational constraints from, let's say, the CMB or from the clustering of galaxies. And so we know that the actual fluctuations trace the cold dark matter power spectrum prediction quite well. But then when you get to smaller scales, eventually we run out of constraints. And there it's essentially just extrapolation. So we're assuming cold dark matter fits well here. So we're just assuming it's going to continue like that towards smaller scales. And in that case, you would continue to rise towards smaller scales all the way until far off to the right, where you would have some cutoff due to free streaming or acoustic damping. But really, we don't know that that's actually what's going on. Particle physics could be different. It could be a warm dark matter model, in which case you would have a cutoff right below where we no longer have observational constraints. Or it could even be a more complicated model, like in this atomic dark matter model by Cyrosine and Sigurdsson, in which there's additional degrees of freedom in the dark sector, and you end up with dark oscillations. Right. So in terms of simulations, you can sort of distinguish between two kinds: the cosmic scale simulations, in which you try to represent a large volume of the universe, a representative volume, and you simulate that with as high as a resolution as you can afford. And this is good, you know, for showing the large-scale structure, the distribution of matter in the universe, so the voids and the filaments. It tells you something about halo mass functions and so on. And then, on the other hand, we have smaller-scale zoom-in simulations. They are no longer simulating a representative volume of the universe, or at least not at very high resolution. And instead, they focus in all of the available computational energy on one halo, for example, the halo that could host the Milky Way, or a cluster-scale halo. And these kind of simulations are the ones that I've been more involved in myself, and they're useful for learning about the internal structure of individual dark matter halos, for example, their density or velocity, dispersion profiles, and of course, also very importantly, learning about the distribution of substructure within these halos. So my own work has been with the Via Láctea project, which Jörg Diemand and Piero Madao and I started back in 2006. And so this was really just simulating at the highest resolution that we could afford the dark matter structure in one Milky Way-like halo. So I'm not going to describe this in too much detail. You've heard this and you know about it. In general, in this talk, I'm going to be going over the pure dark matter-only stuff pretty quickly in the beginning of the talk, and then going to the more baryonic physics stuff later. Right. So why do we care? Well, we want to know what dark matter is, and so we have several different ways forward. Again, you know, in this conference, at least at the moment, talking mostly about these particle physics probes, indirect and direct detection. But we also have astrophysical probes, namely, for example, the senses of dwarf galaxies is thought to be, a measure of the temperature of the dark matter particle. From stellar kinematics, you can learn something about the internal structure of dark matter halos, which tells you something about, again, potentially about the nature of the dark matter particle. Gravitational lensing can tell you about the clumpiness of the halo, as can stellar streams in the galactic halo. So this is just as a reminder, we haven't really been focusing so much on these astrophysical probes so far in this workshop. But essentially all three of these kind of probes that we have, with which we can hope to learn more about the nature of the dark matter particle, depend on the predictions from numerical simulations in one way or the other. And that's what's highlighted here in this kind of matrix, in which I'm just showing in the vertical direction some of these probes, so astrophysical probes, indirect and direct detection. And then on the horizontal direction, just predictions that numerical simulations make, so the large-scale distribution of matter, the abundance of halos, their density profiles, and going into the substructure, and also to some degree the local distribution of dark matter. And you can see wherever the square is highlighted in this greenish yellow, there is a direct connection in the sense that the astrophysical probes depend on the predictions that the numerical simulations make. And so there's clearly a big need for having these simulations. They inform virtually all of these probes that we have. So let me just give two examples from my own work. So the first has to do with indirect detection. So you can use the kind of simulations that I showed before, the Via Láctea simulations, to make, if you want, predictions for what you might see in the gamma ray sky from dark matter annihilation. So you can just put an observer in your simulation at 8 kiloparsecs from the galactic center and sum up the density squared flux in the different directions. And this has been done for a number of years. Here's from some work 5 years ago or so, where I made essentially an all-sky map of annihilation. You can see the galactic center is very prominent. This is really only the dark matter component, not taking into account any kind of astrophysical backgrounds, which of course would swamp out the vast majority of the signal. But you can see that in addition to having a very bright source at the galactic center, you also have occasionally subhalos that are very interesting. Then going down in these panels, I was investigating how accounting for Sommerfeld enhancement can boost the importance of individual substructures with respect to the galactic center. And you can see, depending on what exactly kind of Sommerfeld model you're looking at, the substructure can become quite a lot more important. So you can use these kind of maps to make predictions for, you know, what a satellite like Fermi should see, or in converse, given the fact that Fermi has not really uniquely identified any dark matter subhalos, you can try to put constraints on the parameters that are leading to annihilations in these dark matter subhalos. On the other hand, you can also then use the simulations to quantify the boost factor, the clumpiness of simulations in the halo as a whole. This is, you know, lots of people have been invoking a wide variety of substructure boost factors. Some of them, you know, just kind of pulled up out of thin air, seemingly to me. But what I'm showing here in a calculation, you can show that the actual magnitude of the boost that you expect depends quite sensitively on how you extrapolate to below what the simulations themselves say. So what's plotted here is a measure of the boost factor, the total amount of annihilation luminosity above some minimum mass cutoff, divided by the smooth continuous host halo luminosity, as a function of where you place this minimum cutoff. So, you know, in neutralino supersymmetry, you might have a cutoff here at 10 to the minus 6 solar masses or even less. And then the simulations can only really resolve things out here at 10 to the 5 solar masses and above. And so the simulation data points are given here by the orange, and you can see you get a boost of about unity, so maybe a factor of 2 enhancement, just from the substructure that is resolved in the simulations. So if you want to know what is the total boost, then you have to extrapolate, and you have to assume something for the internal, for the behavior of the substructure, namely its concentration as a function of mass. And here I've just tried 3 different models. You can either just assume that you kind of fit a single power law and just extrapolate the power law down to smaller masses, or you assume some kind of maybe more cosmologically motivated model in which the substructure concentration is set by the time that it collapses, and in that case you get this blue curve. And in the end, the point I'm making here is that it just depends sensitively on what you assume. There can be an order or several orders of magnitude difference in the total amount of boost you can get. Here's a similar calculation that we did with Mark Komiankowski, where instead of, you know, extrapolating the abundances of substructure, we tried to kind of normalize just to the density distribution in the simulations. And again, we find for a total boost going out to, you know, at a virial radius of about a few hundred kiloparsecs, a total boost of maybe a factor of 10 or 20 or so. This red line is actually just giving you the local boost at a given radius, so the enhancement at 100 kiloparsecs compared to the background, which can be much higher, but the cumulative boost is really what you care about, and that ends up being considerably lower. So I would say from these simulations and extrapolating beyond them, my best guess would be that the total boost factor should be fairly low, maybe on the order of 10 or tens or so for galactic scale halos. Of course, you're going to get a slightly larger boost if you're looking at cluster scale halos, because you're going to be integrating over a longer hierarchy of substructure. Right, so that's one example of how dark matter only simulations can inform indirect detection measures.
Wouldn't you see the
booster? Oh, yeah, sure. Go ahead. Yeah.
We're talking about the boost on galaxy scale. Is there like the luminosity of, for instance, an external galaxy like Andromeda? Mm-hmm. But if you, so I guess if you talk about looking towards the galactic center,
yeah,
the enhancement this is probably.
It's much less, yeah. So, yeah, I didn't want to go into like all the details. In this case, I'll refer you to some of these papers that are mentioned here. But you're absolutely right. It depends on the angle that you're looking at in the galaxy. So there's not a lot of substructure towards the galactic center. So you don't expect hardly any boost at the galactic center. But sort of in the diffuse outskirts, you might expect a considerable boost because there's a lot of substructure there. So another dark matter only example is from the is concerned direct detection, and so looking at the velocity structure now. So I know this is a very colorful, distracting movie. I should have not put it in at first. Let's focus on this and this panel, if you can at all, initially. So this is just showing the speed distribution as measured in the numerical simulations. Again, this is a quantity that factors into the direct detection experiments. They are, of course, sensitive to how fast the WIMPs, the incident WIMPs, are moving. So this is showing the speed distribution in the galactocentric reference frame. Typically, people assume a Maxwellian distribution, which is the best fit one is here, and that's shown in this dotted line. What we measure in the simulations is quite different. That's the red line that's really averaging over all particles in a spherical shell at 8 kiloparsecs. And you can see there's clearly a differences. Deficit at the peak and an excess here at these sort of high velocities to the right of the peak. And then there's also local variations around that. If you just measure what is the speed distribution at 8 kiloparsecs, but in a much smaller sample volume, you'll occasionally find spikes due to the presence of either subhalos passing through your sample volume or tidal streams, which will also deposit a lot of particles at a particular speed. So these, you know, especially if you imagine you have some kind of dark matter detection experiments that has very high energy, recoil energy resolution, then you might be able to pick out, like for example, in an axion experiment, then you might be able to pick out individual spikes like these. Now we come to this picture on the right, or this nice movie. This is some work I was doing with Mariangela and David Spergel last year. There we essentially started looking at what is producing this excess of particles here at high speeds. And what this movie is showing is just highlighting, this is still the same Via Láctea simulation, but I'm not showing any of the host halo particles. I'm just highlighting the particles that are falling in four of the most massive subhalos that contribute a lot of particles at 8 kiloparsecs. And you can see that, so I'm just following those as a function of time, and you can see how all these halos get torn apart in the tidal field of the galaxy, and the particles are distributed essentially throughout the whole halo. The scale here is a few hundred, from minus 100 kiloparsecs to plus 100 kiloparsecs. So it's quite large. It's not really the relevant scale for direct detection. What you care about for direct detection is all at 8 kiloparsecs, so in the very center here. And the point is that when you look in the outskirts, you can clearly still see individual tidal streams and tidal features. But in the center, all this material has kind of it's ubiquitous. You see contributions from each of these massive particles at 8 kiloparsecs, and so you're almost guaranteed to find yourself inside what we call a debris flow, which is just the sum of this material that is stripped off from all of these particles. And in this paper, we showed that these contributions, material that has been stripped off from recently accreted satellites, contributes quite a lot to this high excess, this high-speed excess at to the right of the peak of the distribution. Right, so, oh yeah, and we also took this a step further and actually tried to make some sort of more quantitative predictions for how such a debris flow could affect direct detection experiments. If you look at this GV min quantity, I'll talk about that more in detail later, but it's essentially just the integral of F of V over V from some minimum velocity V min to infinity, and that's the quantity that detection is proportional to. You can see that compared to a Maxwellian, a debris flow gives you quite a different shape. So this would be just having a lot of particles at a particular high velocity, almost like a delta function, then you would get quite a different shape in this GV min function. And if you ask how does it affect, for example, the amplitude of modulation, that's what's shown here. Again, the sort of standard halo model is in gray. And if you just put all your particles in a debris flow, so all at a delta function at, say, 300 or 400 kilometers a second, then you would get this kind of very different looking spiky shape. Of course, that's not realistic. We know particles are both in a smooth halo and in a debris flow in a combination of them. So if you do a combination like what you would find in Via Láctea, then you would find this kind of red curve here. So the differences are not quite as pronounced, but you still get a considerably higher modulation amplitude at high recoil energies. And so, of course, that's interesting for, this is for a 10 GeV particle on a germanium target, so kind of inspired by Cogent. And, of course, Cogent measured or reported a fairly high modulation fraction at or amplitude at high recoil energies. And so this kind of debris flow can go in that direction, can give you...
What if the disruption of subhalos?
Yeah, that's yes, that's right.
What is the typical mass? I guess it's the lowest mass you can resolve in that way.
So there is no typical mass. So it depends on if you're asking what is contributing to the debris flow. It actually ends up being the most massive ones, just because they have the most mass to be disrupted and to be deposited. So in this case, it would be in this paper, we actually show plots of like the fraction of debris flow contributed as a function of halo mass, and it ends up being the most massive ones.
Which is what in this case?
Well, so 10, at infall, they would be like 10 to the 10 or so. Solar masses, so and then by the time they get down here and they're disrupted, they're much less masses.
So presumably, there'd be lots of stars in these things as well. Stars.
Yeah, there would be exactly. There would be stellar.
You expect to see all of this signature in stars.
And that's absolutely right, and that's something that Mariangela and I are working on right now. It's trying to do use these same kind of simulations, but to essentially tag dark matter particles in the centers of the halos to mimic kind of the stellar population that would live inside these massive halos and then follow them through and see.
You would have a chemical signature.
You would have a chemical signature as well. So you could do chemodynamics and see if you can pull out these same kind of structures. I mean, we do see tidal streams, individual tidal streams for sure, obviously, Sagittarius stream and many others. But I think we would also expect to see in a halo, if we had a full census of the galactic halo, a similar kind of high speed peak due to stars that were recently ripped out of recently accreted subhalos.
How recent
is recent? Well, once again, the details would depend on, you'd have to look at the paper to see the details, but these are ones that have, fallen in, say, since redshift 2 and have not yet. The point, I guess, is they did not accrete when the halo as a whole was forming, but fell in afterwards. Go ahead.
Can you clarify to me what the difference is between these debris flows and then you previously showed the spikes on there?
Yeah, so the spikes would be individual tidal streams. So this would be if we happen to have one halo that came through and it got disrupted and it deposited a narrow stream and we'd be sitting inside that tidal stream. And so the chances of that are just not very high because there aren't very many subhalos close to the galactic center. And that's also, you could say, like a morphologically 1D feature. And so you just are not likely to be inside that. The debris flow is really the sum of everything. And as I'm showing with this movie in the very center, you're almost guaranteed to be inside of a debris flow.
So in some sense, the debris flow is the difference between the dotted curve and the red. And
yes.
Tidal streams and the green spikes.
Yes, except that this difference is not due to debris flow. This is really just a high speed. Tail that is contributed by debris flow.
Is there a difference between what's in the debris flow and what's in the smooth halo, which is also probably...
Yes, but the difference that we would make is that the stuff that's in the smooth halo was kind of accreted during the formation of the halo, and so it kind of just follows the overall Maxwellian shape. It's peaked at 200 kilometers a second, whereas the stuff that is accreted later on and stripped off later still carries its orbital angular speed. So at 8 kiloparsecs, it's going through at the pericenter passage speed, so 350, 400 kilometers a second, so it's much higher.
So if we wait like 100 giga years, then the debris flow will go to the
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
So what fraction of the local density is it this debris flow?
So this depends on what speed you... So okay, to answer your question, it's only like maybe 10 or 20% if you integrate over all speeds. But if you care about, say, a light dark matter experiment, you care about the high velocity or the high speed tail, this fraction increases to almost 80% or so. So at like 400 or 500 kilometers a second, the vast majority of particles are inside this debris flow or not in the smooth component or the Maxwellian component. And so I'll just refer you to this paper. A lot of these questions that have been asked, we have discussed in this paper and show plots of that. But in this talk, I didn't want to give a talk just on this paper, so that's why I'm not providing all these details.
Just one more thing about stars. I mean, could you argue that the thick disk of the Milky Way is made of debris flow?
Possibly. I'll come to the thick disk later. That would also be a type of debris flow, I think. You can also get a kind of a more of an adiabatic contraction of matter into the into the disk. But that's kind of a, you know, leading into where I'm getting at in this talk. So I'll defer that until later. Right, so as to motivate why we need to go beyond just the dark matter only simulations, which is the result that I've been showing up to now, I thought I'd remind you of several kind of small scale challenges that we have for cold dark matter. I'm sure you guys have heard of most of these, or all of them. On the one hand, we have the missing satellites problem. So just the you know, the discrepancy that is kind of visually highlighted here between what the simulations predict, namely, you know, vastly huge number of substructures, and what you get when you look in the neighborhood of the Milky Way and like actually count dwarf galaxies, you only see on the order of 20 or so. And if you extrapolate to full sky coverage, then maybe there would be 100 or so. But there is still quite a considerable discrepancy just in terms of total number. And that discrepancy persists when you kind of put them on the same footing. So compare, for example, the Vmax or the mass that they had at infall. There's still a considerable discrepancy that grows towards smaller masses. So the other two problems here are the cusp core problem and the too big to fail problem. And since they're going to be more relevant for the later parts of the talk, I'm going to spend a slide describing those in a bit more detail. So the cusp core problem refers to the fact that cold dark matter only simulations tend to predict for the internal structure of dark matter halos a density profile that rises towards the center and is cuspy. So initially this was typically fit by an NFW profile, so that would asymptote to 1 over R. More recent high-resolution simulations find something that is labeled Inosto profile, in which the density profile actually does continue to roll over towards smaller scale and asymptotes to a completely flat density profile. But this rollover is very gradual, and in fact, it's not fully resolved in the simulations. And so I think for all sort of practical purposes, even the Inosto profile on scales that where we can actually have constraints is still quite cuspy. It's just a kind of in the asymptotic behavior, these two profiles differ. Now you can so the predictions are cuspy, at least at the radii where we can measure them. Then you can look at actual observations, and it seems there the observations prefer the underlying dark matter, the underlying potential, which is dominated by dark matter in dwarf galaxies, to not be cuspy but to be cored. And so there's quite a variety of different measurements that point to that fact. So one is you can go and look at 2D gas maps and so measurements of gas inside low surface brightness galaxies. Or you can also look at the radial velocities of stars inside dwarf galaxies. And you can use these motions. You have to do a kind of a genes analysis. You have to assume that they're relaxed in equilibrium. And you can invert these motions to get an understanding of the shape of the potential that is governing these motions. And this was done here for the Things galaxies. So these are two-dimensional H1 rotation curves. Or not just curves, but full rotation maps on this guy. And so then when they invert them, they get a measure of the logarithmic slope, alpha, that is definitely shallower than the prediction of NFW, which would be -1. In some cases, you know, as low as completely flat. But in any case, often quite a bit shallower than -1. Another more recent constraint, which I found quite compelling, was from Walker and Peña Rubio. These guys were looking at two Milky Way dwarf spheroidal galaxies, the Sculptor dwarf and the Fornax dwarf. And those are fairly massive ones, and so they have actually measurements of radial velocities of stars within them, of hundreds and even thousands of stars within them. And so what they were able to identify in each of these two dwarfs two distinct populations of stars, one that was more metal-rich and one that was more metal-poor. And they have slightly different half-life radii, so I think the metal poor one is more spatially extended. And so by doing this kind of genes analysis separately for these two populations, they get two enclosed mass constraints at different radii. And that, of course, gives you a handle on the slope of the underlying density profile. And what they show pretty nicely here is that the density profile is more consistent with a cored or a shallow underlying dark matter distribution. In Sculptor, so NFW would be this blue line, and a cored one would be this red line. So you can see the Sculptor, at least, I think pretty clearly prefers the cored distribution. In Fornax, the case also prefers cored, but it's maybe not quite as clear. Okay, so these are two examples of where the predictions from dark matter simulations don't quite agree with the observations. Another one, you could maybe view this as a combination of the missing satellites problem, and the cusp core problem has been termed the too big to fail problem. This was pointed out by Boyd and Colchin last year. And this involves, again, what's a combination of the internal structure of subhalos and their abundance. So what's plotted in this plot is just for six cold dark matter only simulations that span a range of masses from about 1 times 10 to the 12 solar masses, all the way up to almost about 2.2 times 10 to the 12. So these are like Via Láctea, except these are happen to be the Aquarius simulations. So they have six of them with a very high resolution. And what's plotted in these lines, independently of whether they're solid or dotted for now, these are just circular velocity curves of subhalos. So this is the enclosed mass divided by the radius. And so you can see this typical shape that rises as you go out. And if you were to follow them further out, they would have a peak and then drop off, and that would be the Bmax peak. But here they're looking at the actual shape of the curve. And then they plot on top of these the actual measurements from dwarf galaxies. So in dwarf galaxies, again, we have radial velocities of stars, and you can do this kind of genes analysis inversion to get an enclosed mass at a particular radius, namely the half-light radius of the stars. And so that allows you to put these points on these kinds of panels. So the first thing you can notice is that for every single point, you find a subhalo that goes through these observational points. So that's good news. That means the dark matter simulations are making halos that match, that are able to host these types of observed dwarf galaxies. But what's worrisome is that each of these simulations also tends to predict a handful of halos that are too massive or too dense, so contain too much mass at a fixed radius to host any of these dwarfs. And these were termed too big to fail, because normally you would expect there to be some kind of mass threshold below which you cannot form any kind of stellar component. But these ones, these smaller ones, clearly were able to form, yet we have more massive ones that for some reason seem to not be able to form any stars. So this is simulated quite a bit of work, and I think people are still trying to understand whether this is a real problem or whether you can evade this by just having a lower mass Milky Way. You can see that the more massive you make the Milky Way, the more of these curves are discrepant. If you go to the lowest mass ones, there's really only maybe a handful of them that are discrepant. But on the other hand, there's also constraints that put the mass of the Milky Way a bit more massive than 10 to the 12. So it remains to be seen whether or not this is just a statistical fluke or not. But for now, I think we're going to treat this as an actual problem for dark matter-only simulations. Right, so this motivated going beyond just the dark matter-only simulations. And so you kind of have two ways of going. You can either pursue alternative dark matter physics, including warm dark matter simulations or self-interacting dark matter. And I think there's going to be discussion of this on Thursday. And so since my own work has been more leading me in this other direction, I'm going to be focusing on this for the remainder of the talk. All the results I've been showing so far have completely neglected any baryonic physics. And you might think that's a good assumption since the universe is dominated by dark matter, but it's clear that, at least on small scales, baryonic physics has the potential to really alter the answer, and that's what I'll be demonstrating in the remainder of the talk. Right, so now we're going to go beyond just doing the pure gravity problem and start including hydrodynamic effects. In fact, what people mostly do is they don't even include any kind of magnetic fields or say radiation effects. I mean, people are starting to now, but the most simplest thing to do is just to treat the hydrodynamics. And so then we have just Euler's conservation equations for the density, momentum density, and the energy flux. So even just this fairly simple set of equations allows for quite a different types of techniques for solving them. And people have tried different things. And unfortunately, the answers don't always agree with each other. So one is a Lagrangian technique, where you solve these similarly to the n-body problem. You solve them with individual particles that follow the fluid flow. This would be smooth particle hydrodynamics. Or you can solve these equations on a mesh. And allow the mesh to refine in regions where you need higher resolution. That's called adaptive mesh refinement. Then more recently, Volker Springel developed this repo code, which tries to kind of marry these two and follow the equations of hydrodynamics on a moving, on a deforming mesh. So the mesh is allowed to move with the flow, similarly to a particle-based method, but you're still solving the hydro equations on a discrete mesh. As I mentioned before, so these techniques have different advantages and disadvantages, but they don't always agree with each other, even on individual sort of just test problems. So it's not clear what is the best way to go forward. So I personally have been pursuing this adaptive mesh refinement technique in my own work. So going beyond that, just treating the uncertain beyond the uncertainty from just treating the hydrodynamic equations, we also have to include a lot more additional physics. So that's huge uncertainty comes from that. Gas can cool, so and how it cools as a function of temperature will depend on the metallicity, on the UV background, and so on. And so you have to have some kind of a prescription for that. Once gas cools and becomes very dense, then it will want to turn into stars. So you have to have some kind of prescription for allowing gas to convert into stars in the simulations. Typically, you try to tie yourself to some observational scaling relations between the surface density of gas and the star formation rate, the so-called Kanika-Schmidt relation. But really, you just have parameters that you can tune, so you fall on top of this relation. And you have choices, whether you want to make your star formation proportional to 1/3 fall time, in which case you'll get a superlinear relation, or you can keep this time scale fixed, and then in case you get a linear relation, you can choose to allow gas to form out of all gas, stars to form out of all gas, or you can follow the molecular gas only and only allow stars to form when gas becomes molecular. So there's quite a lot of uncertainty involved here. And then last but certainly not least, there's the feedback. When stars explode, or even before they explode, they emit large amounts of radiation, and there are stellar winds. And then, if they are massive and they do explode as supernova feedback, then they deposit a lot of energy in the surrounding medium—not just energy, but momentum as well, and metals and gas mass. And so, this was only talking about stellar feedback, but of course, you also have potentially the feedback from accreting black holes. And all of these kind of prescriptions are clearly very important and can modify the results from the numerical simulations. So just kind of to advertise some of my own work, which is in progress, we are able to make spiral galaxies in our simulations. So this is an AMR simulation, adaptive mesh refinement simulation, simulating a region of the universe that is 12.5 megaparsecs. And this is showing the gas surface density of something like 80 of the most massive galaxies in the box at redshift 2.5. So this is not today, at earlier times. And I've just projected along the normal of the angular momentum, so the angular momentum vector. And so you can see these are all face-on spiral disks. And you can clearly see when you make nice spiral arms, in some cases there's bulges, there's bars. These look like kind of like real galaxies. And here's the star formation rate for these same systems. And if you just, this is completely unfair, but just comparing some nearby actual very massive galaxies to the stuff that I'm simulating in my box, they look qualitatively similar. We are making galaxies. I'll show more quantitative comparisons for other work in a bit. Before I go on there, I should say, since we have all this uncertainty in how to treat this additional physics, it's maybe not surprising that oftentimes when you ask what is the effect of this baryonic physics on the dark matter, you can get contradictory answers, or you can get different answers depending on how the baryonic physics is implemented. And so here's an example concerning the density profile of the dark matter. The NFW profile. So here's a study from Marcel Tsemp et al. Where they looked at the density profile in a dark matter only simulation. That's just the typical NFW profile. And then once they included baryonic physics, the gas cooled to the center and dragged with it the dark matter, and you got adiabatic contraction, so a steepening. So now the logarithmic slope is closer to 2. On the other hand, this simulation does not include a very effective supernova feedback, and it probably suffers from baryonic overcooling, producing 2 centrally condensed galaxies. So instead, if you implement a very effective supernova feedback that blows out a large amount of the gas repeatedly, so you have impulsive changes to the potential that happen multiple times, then you can get the opposite effect. You can actually lower the dark matter density profile from its initial peaky form to something that is more of a core. So this is maybe reminiscent of what people observe in the dwarf galaxies, a kind of more cored dark matter density profile. Similarly, you can it's even steeper, in this simulation. It approaches r to the minus 3. So I'm not sure that these galaxies are really completely realistic and are matching all observational constraints. It's just to show that, like, depending on how you implement your baryonic physics, you can get quite different results.
So in dwarf galaxies in particular, would you expect a lot of supernova feedback?
Well, that's the trick. So a lot of these very faint dwarfs have not formed a lot of stars. Or, well, we don't know how many stars they formed, but we know they don't have a lot of stars now. So it's difficult to get a huge amount of supernova feedback. So I think for the very smallest ones, you probably don't expect such pronounced effects. But for more massive ones, you might, as I'll show in a bit.
So for, how about for our friends, foreign accent sculpture?
Yeah, for those, I think, so the details really, I think, depend on who you ask. I think that this is like active research, but I think there are certainly simulations, including by Allison and her collaborators, that show that those types of systems can experience enough supernova feedback to really substantially alter their density profile, and I'll show some examples of that in a few minutes.
I actually think there's sort of a consensus. Mm-hmm. The simulations that I run say that you need to have about 10 to the 7 in stellar mass, which is roughly 4x. And that corresponds to a halo mass of about 10 to the 10. Pena Rubia et al. Recently put out a paper also just doing an analytic estimate of how much dark fusion you need. Again, said 10 to the 7. The Irvine group has done analytic estimates that are roughly about 10 to the 7 as well. So I would say that that's sort of a consensus stellar mass.
Yeah, I mean, it has to be somehow related to the halo mass. Right? It can't just be a fixed number. So it should be some stellar mass fraction that is formed. So, but yeah.
Has anyone managed to make these sort of things work for clusters? Since, you know, we have lensing observations, and I assume these baryonic processes are not possible.
Yeah, but you have other baryonic processes then. I mean, but so the cluster observations. Well, more recently, people are finding cores in clusters as well, but I think that's also maybe dependent on how exactly you're centering. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not sure that we have a need for actually turning a cusp into a core inside clusters. But yeah, I mean, I'd be happy to talk to you more about that. Yeah. Right, so maybe in the interest of time, I'll skip this. This is just to show that like the abundance of satellites as a function of radius can also depend on how you implement your dark matter physics. Now, let me show you an example of a simulation that actually has resulted in a realistic-looking Milky Way-like galaxy at redshift zero. This is the ERA simulation that my collaborators, Javier Guedes et al., ran. So this is now a smooth particle hydrodynamics zoom-in simulation. It's similar to the Via Láctea simulation in the sense that you are sticking all your available resources in one halo. But you were following it with the full hydro and star formation and feedback prescriptions. So as a result, you get quite a bit coarser resolution, 10 to the 5 solar mass particles compared to roughly 10 to the 3 solar mass dark matter particles in a cold dark matter only simulation. But you have lots more complicated physics, and so it's not surprising that you can't get to as high of a resolution. But this simulation ends up producing a nice disk galaxy. You can see this is still pretty early times, but it's already forming a fairly extended disk. In the center, you can see a bar that's spinning around. So there's quite a lot of detail here on like how this simulation worked, and I don't think I want to spend the rest of the talk just describing all of these, but suffice it to say that there's quite an efficient supernova feedback prescription that is implemented here, a so-called blast wave prescription that, you know, ejects gas from stars that have recently formed, near stars that have recently become a supernova. So then this is going to go on for a while, so let me just skip to the final output, and this is what the simulation looks like at redshift zero. So you can see a very nice extended gaseous disk with, you can see clearly some holes where supernova feedback has blown out gas. So this doesn't just look nice, it also quantitatively compares very nicely to the Milky Way, at least at redshift zero. If you run this through a radiation transfer code and actually get an estimate of what is the bulge to disk ratio, as an observer would measure it, if this were an external galaxy, you get a bulge to disk of 0.35, which is, you know, exactly what you would expect for a typical SBSC galaxy like our Milky Way. Can look at it, it lies right on the Tully-Fisher relation. These are observational data points. This is the ERA simulation. In terms of the stellar mass fraction, it follows, it lies right on where we'd expect in terms of how much of the gas has actually converted into stars. The rotation curve in the very center is a bit peaky, but in the outskirts, it actually does match the observational constraints quite well. So I think it's fair to say that this kind of a simulation is probably as good as anybody has done today. Certainly not the final word, especially I don't have any plots of this in this talk, but if you look at higher redshift, the agreement is not really quite as good anymore. But at least, you know, as far as things go, this is as realistic as anybody's been able to do. So now let me go on from this and say and start looking at how baryonic physics can actually start to explain some of these puzzles that I mentioned earlier.
So before you move on, can you have the dark matter distribution for this particular halo in a galaxy that forms in a simulation that forms a galaxy like the Milky Way?
Yeah, I'll show you some of that if I hope I get to it. I don't know what the time is, but so it's also in their paper, but I've been looking at both in the very center, but also at 8 kiloparsecs, how is the dark matter distribution affected? So I'll show plots of that. Let me first describe some work that I was doing with Adi Zolotov and Allison Brooks, which is to see how this baryonic physics may affect this too big to fail problem, which again was this worrisome observation or when you compare it to the numerical simulation, that there always is a population of galaxy of subhalos that seem to be too massive to host any of the known dwarfs. So what Adi and Allison noticed is that when they compare in these baryonic simulations, so this is not exactly ARIS, but it's a very similar type of simulation, has the same code and has a very similar physics implementation. When they looked at the circular velocity curves, comparing dark matter only simulations and subhalos in the ones with the baryonic physics, then oftentimes the central mass was reduced, both due to the effects of supernova feedback at high masses, but also due to the additional tidal stripping as the satellites pass close to the actual Milky Way disk in the simulation. And so you can see clearly you're lowering these curves, so that would correspond to lowering these solid curves downwards, which is in the right direction. So in order, these types of simulations don't really have the sufficient resolution to directly do this kind of comparison, but you can try to extract the prescription from these hydro simulations that you can apply to the dark matter only simulations. And so this is what we did in Brooks et al. 2012, where we took the subhalos from the Via Láctea simulations, we applied some prescription for how bright they would be, just based on a sort of simple analytic or semi-analytic model. And then this top panel here is showing only the dark matter only simulations. So again, showing this vCirc at 1 kiloparsec. This would be where this line ends up at 1 kiloparsec. So this is sort of a proxy for how centrally dense they are as a function of this brightness. And so these is where all the Via Láctea subhalos lie. And you can ask how many are in this red box. And there is about 27 of them in the dark matter only simulation. But if you ask how many are actually in the Milky Way, in this box, there would only be about 5. So this is another way of expressing the too big to fail problem. We just have too many, too centrally concentrated systems in a dark matter only simulation.
So what about uncertainties in our understanding of the Milky Way? So I think you mentioned briefly uncertainties in the mass of the Milky Way.
Yeah, right.
If you change the mass.
Yes, that potentially can explain it, but it's much easier to say than actually to do, because there are also constraints on the mass of the Milky Way, so you can't make it arbitrarily low mass.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can argue that the Milky Way has a mass of like 7 × 10⁻¹⁰, then there is no too big to fail problem. But there are other constraints that make that seem quite unlikely.
Okay, so it's difficult to solve this problem just by saying there's an uncertain mass of the Milky
Way. Yeah, I think people are still considering that as one potential explanation, but I want to show that you don't even have to go that route. You can also just consider the additional physics that is not included in the simulations that give you the too big to fail problem, and that can also explain this. So, and that's what I'm showing here. If you apply a prescription that is extracted from the hydro simulations to the dark matter only simulations, then a lot of these points just move downwards. That's just this effect. And this is, again, a combination of having a supernova blowout feedback at very high masses, but also tidal stripping, enhanced tidal stripping, as they come close to the galactic center. In fact, if you account for, by looking at the orbits of the subhalos, how close they get to the galactic center, you can estimate how many of them would be fully tidally disrupted. These are halos that, in the dark matter-only simulation, survive. But once you account for the baryonic physics, namely the galactic disk, then they would get completely destroyed. So, but the upshot is that once you account for this kind of prescription, you end up with on the order of 5 or so visible halos in this box, which is in very good agreement with the observational constraints. So this is just one example how accounting for baryonic physics can alleviate this kind of discrepancy. Another is from some of my own recent work. Again, this is not a fair comparison because it's at redshift 2.5. But you can ask, what is the stellar fraction in a full simulation in which you allow the star formation not just to scale with the scale in a linear fashion with the host of the halo, but instead you account more properly for the fact that star formation can only occur in gas that is able to become molecular, and that depends on how metal enriched it becomes. So there's a lot of details here that I don't at the moment have time to go into. But as a result, you can see in the simulation, you get quite a large scatter in the stellar mass fraction as a function of halo mass at low masses. So this could be another way of explaining this kind of behavior, where you would just argue that some of these halos just weren't able to convert their gas to molecular gas, and therefore were not able to form stars, whereas others were, and so you just get a big scatter. And so that could explain why some of these halos themselves don't host any stars, even though less massive ones were able to host stars.
Sorry, but just feel back one.
Yeah.
Minus 16, minus 17, that's where the imaginary clouds are in our galaxies. So it looks like a
yes.
number of objects that we don't see massive dwarfs in the nebula, is that right?
No, so are you talking about these points here?
Yeah,
but these are ones they have a cross through them. These are ones that we estimated based on their orbit that we extracted from the simulations passed deep enough into the potential that when you account for the additional baryonic disk there, would have been tidally disrupted. So this is essentially following a prescription by Peña Rubia et al, who did this. They actually threw in galaxies into isolated test galaxies and found how does the amount of mass that is stripped off them depend on the distance and their orbital parameters. And so we applied that same prescription to the orbits from our simulated halos. And so all these are disrupted. It's true that in the Via Láctea 2 simulation, we actually don't really have a Magellanic Cloud analog, so one that is massive enough to host the Magellanic Cloud. But again, this is one simulation. So. So let me move on. So in order to understand the baryonic physics effect, it's nice to have a dark matter-only counterpart. And so we do have this for Eris, for the Eris simulation. This on the left is the Eris dark simulation, which is the same run, the same initial conditions, except we don't account for any of the baryonic physics. This is just dark matter-only. And then this is the Eris simulation, which is the dark matter halo that gave you that exact same, that Milky Way-like galaxy that we saw before. So now we can do kind of direct comparisons. So now let me talk a little bit about, so Gianfranco, that's going towards your question. So what is the, so for the next few slides, I'm going to be talking about the effects on the local dark matter at 8 kiloparsecs, including the dark disk. So right now here, I'm just showing the distribution, the density profile, essentially. So there's quite a few different lines on here. The first one maybe to look at is this dashed magenta line. That's what you get for the Eris dark simulation. So this is just a dark matter only simulation. It's like Via Láctea 2, but with considerably less resolution. But over the range of scales that we're interested in here, this is a typical kind of NFW-like profile. And it gives you a local dark matter density at 8 kiloparsecs of about 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter, just like what everybody expects. Then you can look at the Eris simulation, and you can just ask, what is all dark matter in the disk? So now we actually have a disk in the simulation, so we can just pick a region of interest that is along the disk and has a certain vertical extent, in this case 0.1 kiloparsecs plus or minus, and you can just ask how much dark matter is in there, and that's this as a function of radius, as a function of radius in the plane now, and that's what this black line is showing, and so it's clearly a little bit enhanced compared to the dark matter only simulation. And so that is, you could call a dark disk. But actually, when we go and do a kinematical decomposition between the particles that are in the sort of overall diffuse distribution of particles and the ones that are kind of co-rotating with the disk, then we have a way to isolate which dark matter actually is in the disk. And that's what's shown here in this red line. And you can see that's quite a bit removed. And it only makes up about half of this difference between the magenta curve and the black curve. And so actually, there's some additional component, some additional enhancement in the disk region that is not co-rotating with the dark matter, with the stars, but instead is just kind of probably an adiabatic compression, a contraction that has increased the density in the disk plane. Now, the other thing you can tell here is that if you look at the star and gas, that's already clearly dominating inwards of 10 kiloparsecs or so. So the potential is definitely baryon dominated in the center, or even at 8 kiloparsecs. So now this was just the density profile. You can see there seems to be a small but significant enhancement comparing Eris to Eris dark at 8 kiloparsecs. Now we...
How would this plot look if you, for Eris dark, show the spherical shape?
Well, it's not terribly... It's a bit lower than this black curve.
Okay.
I can show you later. I don't have this plot here on me right now. So now I do have that compared for the speed distribution also in a second. So now we can look at the distribution of the velocity components. Here's the radial, the azimuthal, so in the disk plane, and the phi component. So that's moving out of the disk. This is showing in the halo rest frame. This is the total Eris dark matter distribution. No, sorry, all the dark matter in the disk region of interest. And this is the contribution from the dark disk that we have identified as being co-rotating with the stellar component. You can see that here. If you look at the velocity, the azimuthal component, all the stars are rotating at about 200 kilometers a second. And there's this little dark matter contribution that is co-rotating with the dark matter. Now we can look at the same thing both in the rest frame, but I got rid of the stars, so I'm just zooming in a bit. But now I'm comparing it to the Eris dark spherical shell. So in the Eris dark, we don't have a preferred direction. We don't have a galaxy plane, so we're just averaging over an entire spherical shell. And that's what's shown here in these gray curves. And the dotted line is always the best fit Gaussian. It's the Gaussian with the same peak speed. And so you can see this typical effect that we've observed before, that when you look at, for example, the total, the velocity modulus distribution, then the dark matter only simulation has an excess compared to the Maxwellian. That's what this is showing. But then when you look at the air simulation, it has an additional enhancement at high velocities. So you shifted even more particles to high speeds. And this is in the halo rest frame, and that's due to this, at least partially due to this enhanced contribution of particles that are co-rotating with the stars.
What's the top and bottom? I'm sorry.
So I'm showing three different speed components, so radial, azimuthal, and vertical, and this is just the velocity modulus. Now I've converted this to the Earth rest frame, so on June 1st. And now you can see that now the scale here has shifted. Once you do that, then all this dark disk component is more or less close to zero because it's more or less co-rotating with the stars. So then you get a more pronounced excess here at low velocities, at low azimuthal velocities, comparing Eris to Eris dark. And if you look at the speed distribution, the velocity modulus distribution, then again, this dark matter disk is contributing an excess here at very low speeds. But you can also see an excess here at high speeds, and that is not due to this component that is co-rotating with the stars, but this additional adiabatically contracted matter that just increases the density in the disk plane without actually co-rotating with the stars. You can ask, what is the effect of this on the direct detection signal? So again, this is this quantity GB min, which the direct detection scattering rate is directly proportional to. And you can plot this as a function of Vmin. So again, to remind you, if you have a very heavy dark matter particle on like a xenon target or something, then you're going to be integrating. Then Vmin is going to be quite low, and you're going to be integrating essentially over this entire speed distribution. But if you have a light dark matter particle or a light target, then this Vmin is going to be quite high. And then you might start noticing very large effects. So here's the, depending on what you're asking. So the dark disk contribution is confined to low speeds. You can see that just because the dark disk is contributing mostly at very low speeds. So the differences here that I find are only a few 5% or so. They're not very important at very low speeds. Then when you go out to higher Vmin, though, the differences between the Eris simulation and the Maxwell-Boltzmann, that's the dotted line, or the differences between Eris and Eris dark, that's the solid line, start to shoot up at about 400 kilometers a second. And again, that's just due to this additional material at high speeds that is from the adiabatic contraction. You can look at the same effects for the modulation. Here's the modulation amplitude, and here's the modulation fraction, and here's the modulation peak. And again, at low speeds, the actual effects from the co-rotating dark disk are pretty small, less than only a few percent or so. When you get to the high speeds, then the changes in modulation amplitude and modulation fraction and so on start to become much more significant. Lastly, I thought I'd show this slide that I got from Joachim Etzier, who left last week. But a few months ago, I sent him these distributions because he was interested to see how this affects the capture rate of dark matter in the Earth. It turns out that actually is very sensitive to the low-speed tail, again, because in order to capture dark matter in the solar system, you can either scatter off of the sun or you can get gravitationally scattered off of Jupiter. And in both cases, you're more sensitive to the very low-speed tail. So he compared this to a dark disk model that Reed et al. Was looking at. So this is a very optimistic one in which you have half of all the dark matter in the disk is co-rotating. So it's a very whopping dark disk, and that's what produced this speed distribution. Whereas the ones that I'm seeing in Eris is this dashed line. So there is a little bit of an excess at low speed, but it's nothing like this huge peak at very low speeds. And so then, not surprisingly, when you look at the capture rate, this is now the capture rate as a function of the WIMP mass. There are certain resonances here due to carbon, oxygen, and iron. And you can see that the enhancement, if you have this like really whopping dark disk, there's this optimistic Reed et al. Disk, then you get huge increases in the capture rate in the Earth. When you look at our maybe slightly more realistic dark disk, then the increases are only a factor of a few or so in the capture rate. This is just a result of this dark disk component not being hugely, not being as whopping as what people have often assumed in the past. Oh, so that was all I wanted to say on direct detection. Now let me say a few words on the galactic center, because that's been occupying us here. So I also found some interesting baryonic effects in the dark matter at the galactic center. And this was motivated by the Fermi line, which, as we've been talking about, is at the roughly 2 sigma level, not centered on the galactic, on Sagittarius A star, but instead is offset in along the plane by about 2 degrees or so, corresponding to roughly 200 parsecs. So people initially thought maybe this should be counted as a strike against the dark matter annihilation interpretation, because you'd really expect it to be centered on the galactic halo. But so I'm finding that maybe that is not a good reason to discount dark matter annihilation interpretation, because I do often see the dark matter density being, the peak of the dark matter density being displaced from the actual potential minimum. So that's what's shown here. And these plots, these are just projections of dark, or not projections, actually slices of the dark matter density field through the 3 Cartesian planes. So this is a slice, x-axis, y-axis, and z-axis in the Eris simulation. And the white cross gives you the potential center, so the dynamical center of the simulation. And then these the colors highlight the density peak, or the dark matter density, and the red cross highlights the peak of the dark matter density. So you can see in these dark matter only simulations, Via Láctea, G Halo, and Eris Dark, the peak of the dark matter density is always, you know, within one resolution element, so to speak, of the dynamical center. But when you look at the baryonic simulation, the one that includes the baryonic physics, it often seems to be offset from the galactic center. So this is just showing one snapshot. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, what's the contrast of
those
color? I mean, how much is the peak, like?
Yeah, it's not
is that
huge.
Like 1.01 or is it?
No, this is in density, you know, I want to say like tens of percent. So it's not a huge effect. I'll show you in a second. Yeah, but I'll show you for the annihilation, for the line, you probably want more like factor of 2 or so. But I'll show you in a second.
Is that due to substructure that I'll see?
No, it's not. So you can see that here in the bottom. So here I'm just showing a few different snapshots separated by 1.5 megayears, and this is showing just contours of the dark matter density field. And this red dot is essentially the 95% percentile density, so the highest region. And you can see here in the second to last plot, I've just highlighted all the particles that are within one gravitational softening of the dark matter offset, and then just 1.5 megayears later, all those same particles are already dispersed through the box, yet there is a new dark matter density offset. So it's not a kind of a bound structure that follows, that is kind of held together by its own gravity that is moving around. Instead, it would be some kind of a, you know, density excitation, for example. And I have a.
So what is the, red is the 95% level?
Yeah,
the other one around that?
The other one's, I forget now, like 90th or something. I forget. I made it a while ago. So interestingly enough, it's not just an offset. We also see the formation of a core in the center. So this is now really, I should say, even here at this plot, we're really pushing the resolution limit. The gravitational softening of these simulations is about 100 parsecs, and we're talking about features at, you know, 300, 400 parsecs. So this is getting pretty far in. So it's hard to know where to really draw your convergence radius. Where do you think you really trust your dark matter density distribution? But if I just look at, say, the mean enclosed density as a function of radius, here's for a few simulations that we looked at, the dark matter only ones, you know, continue to rise. The Eris Dark actually kind of tends to fall off as well. But the Eris simulation clearly becomes flat in mean enclosed density. You can actually measure the slope of the density profile. So here I chose a radius that encloses 5,000 particles, which, you know, is maybe a reasonable convergence measure. That would tends to be at about 10 softening or so. And you can see the logarithmic slope here of the Aries dark simulation pretty much is NFW. It's a little bit shallower maybe, but more or less minus one. But the Aries simulation actually at the same radius that encloses the same number of particles, it actually has a fairly much shallower slope. What is the softening? It's 100. What? The same. Because they're the same. They're both 100 parsec.
No, but I guess I'm just confused. I thought
the baryonic
physics that was supposed to be giving rise to the softening.
Oh, no, sorry. I'm speaking too fast. The softening is a parameter that is just meant to prevent particles from actually hard scattering off of each other, since the dark matter particles are just kind of tracers of a continuous density field. So you actually need to soften the gravitational interaction when they come close to each other. So both the baryonic physics and the Aries dark physics have a gravitational softening parameter in them, and it's both set to 100 parsecs. And then you get an additional softening from the actual baryonic physics that is not directly put in by hand, it's just an outcome of the situation.
So the difference between, say, Via Lactea and Aries dark is by hand?
Yes, that's right, exactly. That's just the fact that Via Lactea has, 1,000 times more particles and therefore can afford much smaller softening.
Say the blue and the red
is baryonic physics.
Just curiously, it's interesting, but why is it at 100 parsecs or a few hundred parsecs, right when the softening is becoming an issue, that you see this effect? Because physically, I would think it also happened at 1 kiloparsec. So what's the physics? Why is the physics changing so dramatically in the inner 100 parsecs?
The offset varies. That's what I'm showing here. But you're right. It seems to be, scattering around several gravitational softenings. We don't have enough resolution to run the same kind of computational power to run the same simulation with a much smaller softening. That would be nice to see that it actually converges. We can go the other way and ask what happens when you look at a simulation with much larger softening. And indeed, the offset does move somewhat out with the softening, but not at any linear scale. So it seems to be on the getting close to converge. So that's as much as I can say about it. I don't think there's any, so, if you ask,
if you're going to have a core at the center of your system, you would think that, I'm just kind of curious, what would be the physics behind that would actually drive, and on the time scales that you're looking at, I could imagine there could be some physical process that would
Happen. So the preferred physical process that I actually like in terms of both the origin of the offset and the formation of the core is an interaction with the stellar bar. So the distribution of stars in the center is not azimuthally symmetric. They're actually a stellar bar has formed that has a certain pattern speed that's moving around. And if you look at the angle from the galactic center to the dark matter offset with respect to this bar, they trace each other. So there is clearly a kind of periodic behavior. So that's not complete proof, but that to me seems to imply that it has something to do with the bar. When you have a bar, you have certain dark matter particles that can be in orbit. It can be in resonant orbit with the bar. They can be captured with it. So the co-rotation resonance is one, and the inner Lindblad resonance is another.
Some analytic models found this too, like that's where you have bars and things like that.
Right, absolutely. You can just do an analytic calculation. You can show that some dark matter orbits are actually captured resonantly in that case. And in that case, if you have particles that are captured in a resonance with the bar, there actually is an exchange of angular momentum that destroys the bar, but imparts energy to these dark matter particles, and that can push dark matter out. So in that case, you might expect from one resonance to smooth out the cuspy nature of the dark matter density profile, make it more cored, but then also get from a different resonance particles that are captured off center
from your simulation, you must, if that's true, then you must be seeing some particles that are just getting ejected from the core.
So there would be a redistribution. I'm not sure that so to answer your question, I have not followed the orbits of individual particles to make sure that's going on, but I'm...
Because that'd be kind of a nice check of the things.
Right, you can make, what you could do is actually calculate the orbits of individual particles and measure their frequencies. And we also know what is the frequency of the bar and show that they actually are in a resonant capture. So this is not something I've done yet. That would be really the proof of it. To me, the fact that there is this alignment with the bar and the fact that the offset has a period of about 70 mega years, which is comparable to the period of the bar, that's pretty good circumstantial evidence that the bar has something to do with it.
I thought that you said when you looked at the these particles that were forming this density
peak
off-center, that it wasn't bound, that it wasn't a group, that
exactly.
The particles were getting scattered.
And that's right. That's exactly what you expect for particles that are captured in a resonance. These would not be particles that are bound together by self-gravity. Different particles would be in this offset at different times. It'd be like a spiral density wave in the Milky Way, where a spiral, you know, the stars that are in a spiral are not the same stars at different times. There's just a density enhancement. So it would be the same kind of effect.
But also it's not obvious that this is, I mean, I know that this is sort of an ongoing point of research, right, in terms of like the bar and the center of our own galaxy.
Yes.
So, I mean, can you at least maybe comment a little bit on that? I mean, the comparison between your simulation and, about what's happening in the center of our galaxy.
The only thing I can comment is that we do know the Milky Way has a bar. It's aligned on like a few degrees off our line of sight. So I think that's consistent with having an offset that is away from the galactic center, because it would be captured in the resonant with this bar. But that's probably all I want to say about that. I guess the more general point I would take away from all of this is that this is one instance where baryonic physics has really order of unity changed the distribution of dark matter in the galactic center, even out at a kiloparsec. So, you know, just extrapolating NFW down to the event horizon of the black hole to get some limit on the annihilation rate from the galactic center is not something that I think is a wise thing to do. Talking about the annihilation rate, this goes back to the contrast question before. So at the resolution that we have right now, the annihilation contrast between the offset point and the galactic center is only, you know, 10-15%. So that's not enough. First of all, if you believe that the line actually is offset, which, you know, as we heard, is only about currently at 2 sigma level, but if it is offset, then you would need about, more like a factor of 2. Difference in brightness as opposed to this 10%. But the caveat here is that our simulations, you know, we're really pushing the resolution limit, and so it's possible that if we had much higher resolution, we would resolve more of this resonance structure, and maybe we would that would turn into a more cuspy and higher contrast difference. So I think that remains to be seen. You can also see here just in this image that there's kind of a secondary peak on the left side, and that depends somewhat on when you look at this last snapshot. There happen to be kind of like two comparable offset densities, whereas at other times it's always just on one side. Right, so I have probably already gone over time, but I'll just put up my conclusions here, that I showed you some examples of very ultra high resolution dark matter only simulations that produce a ton of substructure, both in space and subhalos, and also in velocity space, streams and debris flows. And these clearly have important implications for indirect detection experiments. But I think by themselves, on galactic scales, these dark matter-only simulations are becoming, you know, they're nearing the end of their usefulness, because there are so many other physics effects that can affect things importantly. For example, so baryonic physics is one that I've been investigating. Unfortunately, at the moment, the answers depend somewhat on how you are implementing your baryonic physics. So you can get, in some cases, the adiabatic contraction, but in other cases, you might remove dark matter from the center. Nevertheless, I think important progress is being made. We're actually simulating galaxies that look realistic, at least at some points. And so we can start to use those to show how the expectations from dark matter-only simulations are modified. And I showed you three examples of that. So thanks, and I'll take more questions if there are any.
Thanks a lot, Mike. So you had already many questions. There's something else you'd like to discuss? Think about like weak points rather than specific questions.
Can you talk a little bit about cost in terms of computing?
Yeah, so the dark matter only simulations are at the moment completely just computationally cost limited. So if you know, give me more CPU hours and faster computers, then I can run a higher resolution simulation. But by the same token, it's actually hard to get these really huge allocations for doing just dark matter only simulations, because rightly so, the, you know, review panels will say, well, you should also include other physics. In that sense, when you start going to including baryonic physics, I think the game is more still in the sort of understanding how to implement this physics, or even what physics is important to be implemented. And there, I don't think it's the most fruitful to run these like hero simulations where you throw millions of CPU hours at them. Instead, I think there's more to be learned by somewhat smaller scales, but exploring wide ranges of different parameters.
Very naive question, but so the sort of the Fermi bubbles and the Unimap days, I mean, those are pretty big features. Is the possible physics that could be describing those features, is that at all something that's been included in the invariance?
Not in anything that I've worked on, but definitely people have included black hole feedback. That's generally, I would say, even more uncertain how it's done. It's really hard to understand exactly how the black hole is coupling to the gas. I mean, in a simulation, how to incorporate that. But when people do include it in some way, you can certainly get effects like bubbles being blown out. And so that's not something that we've included in the simulation so far, but probably should.
Can I ask you very quickly about the specific point you were making here?
Yeah.
So, you argued that often even the sign of the effects is unknown, you know, making things more concentrated or less concentrated and so on. And then you were arguing that, you know, progress has been made in the sense of, you know, getting with every simulation something that looks like the Milky Way in terms of, you know, bulge to this, where shear and things like that. However, one thing that I'm not sure I understand. So if I look, for instance, at the dark matter profile you've shown in the case of the area simulation of variance, it doesn't really look like you know about the simulations at Augers at all, done in Zurich. You know, they also were saying that you know, they had the right bulge to this ratio and everything. So from the baryonic point of view, so from the point of view of stars and gas, everything seemed to be quite the same, actually, as in the area simulation. But the dark matter profile seemed to be a bit more like contracted, especially on the scale of the bar, basically. So when you go down to 2 kilobars, maybe Miguel can confirm, if you remember, there was this kind of enhancement of the dark matter density on those scales.
But I also see an enhancement.
Yeah, they do see that,
yeah. I mean,
but not on those scales, right? Because it was progress. Sorry?
So there is an enhancement here as well. I don't know, it's not like factor of 2, but I mean, this is actually in the disk, but so.
Yeah, I guess it boils down to a comparison, but you know, I had the impression that it was like NFW down to like 2 kiloparsecs, and then something shooting up more you know, sharply there. So my question would be,
if you
run like 100 of these simulations, what do you get? Do you always get consistently always the same result, or does it vary and does it scatter between one simulation to the next?
Yeah. My guess would be, I think you really have to tie yourself to, are you actually reproducing observational constraints? And so if everything is reproduced equally well in both simulations, and then you do see wildly different results, and maybe it would depend on things like the accretion history, or maybe it's just saying that there is not a unique solution and you can have different physics. I mean, that's my worry as well. That's my point, that it's not, I don't think we're at the state yet where we have implemented all the physics in the one right way, or even that we've identified all the physics, so I don't know.
Related thoughts on this stuff. So I don't recall if the Edwards Fund had outflows from their simulations. When we're seeing quark creation in these simulations, they are tied to galactic outflows, which I find very encouraging because there is evidence for galactic outflows as well. And so it could be that you know, it has something to do. I can add 4 data points to this, and I can tell you that in 4 of my Milky Way galaxies, we also get kiloparsec quarks. And in that case, there's not always bars, and I think it's tied to outflows in that case. And so it may have something to do with if you've implemented your physics in such a way that you've drawn galactic outflows or not.
Right. And then, of course, like your simulation and the air simulations are using, to a large extent, the same physics, the same code, the same. So it's nice to have. Yeah, it's pretty. It's at least not as different than yours. Right. Which, right. But you know, it's not as different as yours compared to, say, Aagaard's is, or compared to a repo simulation, and so on. So I think we're just not at the point yet where we can say uniquely that we've settled the question.
And you take, you know, going back to the question, we take half a million hours or so to run, which means that's why we have 5 or 6 million. Not a false statistical.
I'm absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, even the data on the inner profile of dark matter is controversial. There's been recent claims that an asteroid NFW are not right at all, but one should in fact use a core of isothermal.
You mean, so you took
a very large core, you know, to fit all the data on rotation.
Milky Way. Yeah, I saw that 10 kiloparsec core.
And they fit everything, so.
Yeah.
Yeah. But generally, though, I mean, the rotation curve in the center is dominated by the baryonic physics.
Exactly.
So actually, you can put almost anything in the dark matter in there. So if you're willing to depart from a monotonic dark matter distribution, you can probably have something that has zero dark matter in the galactic center, and you're still going to fit the rotation curve. Mm-hmm. The constraints on the dark matter really come from the outskirts. I mean, that's what you can already see here. Dark matter dense. This is just density, not even enclosed density. So we're already like almost an order of magnitude higher in baryons versus dark matter. So the dark matter is you can do anything you want with it there.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Mike.
Sure.